The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Janet Jones, and I'd like to welcome you to City Bible Forum. Especially if this is your first visit with us today, a warm welcome to you. Well, what happens normally at these forums is that after this brief introduction, I'll be reading the part of the Bible that's been printed in your outlines that you were given when you walked in. And then after that, our guest speaker, Luke Tattersall, will be getting up and speaking, addressing us for about 20 minutes on the topic of how do you take the Bible seriously when it seems there are so many ways to God. During the talk, please feel free to take notes or if you like, write down any questions that you have arising from the talk on the slips of paper that you've been given and hand them in at the end of the talk whilst I'm giving announcements. And these will be handed to Luke, who will do his best to answer those questions in the time that he has. So now I'll read aloud from the section of the Bible found inside your outlines. You may like to follow along with me. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean." All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now, what you worship as something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you."
Well, I hope that when I'm finished speaking, you're not saying to yourselves, "What is this babbler talking about?" as it says in the passage there. But it's the idea of truth that we're going to be having a look at today. I think it would be safe to say that the idea of truth in our society has taken a bit of a battering in the last few years, in the last 20 or 30 years. People have become suspicious of the idea of truth. It's seen as being something of an elusive idea. We doubt that our politicians tell us the truth. We know that half of what we read in the newspapers or see on TV isn't the truth. We don't think that we know the truth about what happened with the war in Iraq. The whole idea of truth has been fairly seriously devalued. You might be old enough to remember the TV show, The X-Files. It sort of symbolised in some ways our attitudes about truth. We have Mulder, the believer, and Scully, the skeptic, working together to try and find the truth because, as the TV show said, the truth is out there. But as the show wore on, we began to wonder whether or not it is possible to find the truth. Maybe there is no truth to find after all, or maybe if the truth is there, we're not going to be able to uncover it. There's a good chance we'll never know things for certain. We live in a world today where the idea of universal truth, it's probably considered to be a bit of an old-fashioned concept and perhaps something that doesn't exist. We live in a world where truth is seen as a subjective thing. Something can be true for you, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be true for me. Truth's become a bit more of a personal concept, hasn't it? I mean, we can talk about finding our own truth, but that may not necessarily be the truth for others. That's the case in our society in a variety of different areas, but the place where you see it most clearly is when it comes to religion. People are dismissive of the idea of religious truth. It's considered the height of arrogance to say that your religion is true, or perhaps to suggest that some other religions may not be true. We call it religious pluralism. that all religions are considered to be of equal value, and we're encouraged not to think of our religion as having more truth or less truth than any other religion. Tolerance is the buzzword. That people are encouraged to accept that all religions contain equal amounts of truth, and to say anything otherwise, well, that's simply intolerant. So how have we arrived at this point? How do we get to the place where we think that truth might in fact be obsolete? How do we reach the point where our society wants to say that it's not right to hold to your religion being true and others not being true? Now, if I had my philosophy lecturers from university or theological college here with me, they'd be horrified by what I'm about to do. So please accept that as an apology to begin with, because what I want to do is just give you a brief history of Western thought, okay? And you'll be dumbfounded just how brief this is going to be. In the 18th century, there was a period known as the Enlightenment, and this was a time when reason began to take over as the dominant authority in society. It's very closely linked to the scientific revolution, but slightly separate from it. So this period of enlightenment, the primary authorities in the society of the day were rejected. The old authorities, the old institutions, things like the monarchy and things like the church, were rejected as the authority of the day, and reason now became the primary authority. Science and reason took centre stage. They were going to give us the answers to all of life's mysteries, solve all of life's problems for us. People believed that if you applied scientific principles, if you applied reason to the issues that we face in our world, then all of our problems can be solved. Well, towards the end of the 18th century, the Enlightenment moved into another period that we call modernism. And again, that same optimism was still there, that science and reason can deliver the truth. But then there were two events at the beginning of the 20th century that kind of put a dent in that optimism. The First World War and the Second World War. People began to wonder whether or not science and reason could deliver what was hoped for, what was promised. Instead of all of our questions being answered, well, it seemed that we had more problems to solve and less answers to the questions than we'd first thought. Well, modernism gave way to postmodernism, the age that we live in today. And postmodernism, as the name would suggest, is a reaction against modernism. It's suspicious of truth claims, and the idea of universal truth is pretty well rejected by postmodernism. See, that's the world that we live in. That's the air that we breathe, and it helps us to understand the religious pluralism that we see around us, and helps us to understand a number of other things in our society as well. Now, as I said, this wasn't intended to be a philosophy lecture, and that is a very, very brief history of Western thought, and I wouldn't want to say that I've covered everything there, and there will be no quiz, so that's okay. But if you had to find the one statement in Christianity that people find most objectionable, then it comes to us from the lips of Jesus, where he says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." I mean, a statement like that, well, that's just seen as being the height of arrogance, isn't it? I mean, it's arrogant that Jesus would claim that there is only one way to God, and doubly arrogant that he would claim that he is that way to God. But if there's one statement above all else that defines Christianity, I think that would probably be it. That Jesus is the way to be right with God. That Jesus is the one who makes it possible for us to know God, who reveals the truth about God, that Jesus is the way to God. So how do you go about holding to that truth when our society says that's arrogant, that's intolerant, that's to suggest that other religions perhaps aren't true? Well, in the pluralist society that we live in, I think we need to realise that this is not a new thing, the pluralism that we see around us. And you've got that Bible passage there in front of you from Acts chapter 17. Some 2,000 years ago, this was the experience of the Apostle Paul. He was in Athens, a city that was known for the worship of a vast variety of gods. All the gods of the known world were considered to be represented there. religious pluralism was the dominant force in that world at that time. One of the writers around the time of the Apostle Paul said that it was in fact easier to find a god in Athens than it was to find a man. There were that many statues of all of the different gods represented in Athens. So how did Paul respond? Well, I think his responses would be the same way that he would respond to the religious pluralism in our world today. So let me take you through and show you how it is that Paul responds to the circumstance that he finds himself in. His first response is right there in that very opening verse, verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. NIV says distress. The way that it's really translated is that he's stirred in his spirit. He's upset. He's saddened by what he sees around him. He is saddened by the dozens and dozens of religions that he sees. Now, that's not the way that our society reacts to the religions around us, is it? In fact, religion today is seen as being a bit of a fashion accessory, that there are numerous celebrities who involve themselves in a variety of different religions. Let me give you a couple of examples. Richard Gere has closely aligned himself with Buddhism and become very good friends with the Dalai Lama in recent years. Madonna, you might be able to see the little red cord on her hand there. She's involved herself in a form of Jewish mysticism known as Kabbalah. These guys have become the poster boys for Scientology. See, the impression that you get is that religion's a bit like an ice cream flavour. You just choose whichever one suits you. I mean, essentially, they're all the same. Whichever one suits you is the one that you should have. But when the religions of our world are presenting vastly different claims about who God is, and when the religions of our world are presenting vastly different ideas about how to be right with God, well, they can't all claim to be right. And if Jesus says that he is the way, the truth, and the life, well, he's making a fairly exclusive claim. I think he's saying that it's not like choosing an ice cream, that there are fundamental issues involved here. We are dealing with who it is that we are as human beings. We are dealing with issues of meaning and purpose in our life. We're dealing with issues of life after death. This is not something that you treat like choosing an ice cream. This is actually quite serious. And the consequences are quite serious as well. Well, can I say the next thing that Paul does is that he makes sure that he is informed about the world that he's speaking to. Paul is informed about the religion of Athens. He's informed about the culture of Athens. He's walked around, he's seen the gods that are there, he's talked with people in the marketplace, he's talked with people about what it is that they believe. He understands the culture. He even quotes their own poets to them when he stands up before them in the Areopagus. He feels that he can talk intelligently about their religion, about what it is that the people in Athens believe. Now, can I say on both of those things, that's something that we should seek to do as well. Understand the world that we live in. Understand the way it is that other people think. Understand the culture of our society as well. With the growing pluralism in Australia, we need to seek to understand the other religions that are being represented here in this country. We need to continually work at understanding our own culture. What is it that's shaping people's thinking? What are the movies that people are watching, the books that people are reading, the music that they're listening to? They're the things that will shape the way that our society thinks. And if we want to engage people in meaningful discussion, then we need to understand those things. But Paul is also still committed to the truth about Jesus. See, have a look at what happens in verse 17. Immediately after we hear that he is distressed by what he sees, look at what he does. Verse 17, so he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. When Paul goes to the Areopagus, he's still committed to that one true God idea. To there being one truth. I'm sure that must have been a hard thing for him to do. I'm sure the temptation would have been there to say, well, look, you've got a whole bunch of gods here. Let me throw one more into the mix for you. But that's not what he does. Paul says that there is one God who made the world. There is one God who gives us life and breath and everything else. There is one God to whom every person will ultimately be accountable. I'm sure that the message probably would have gone down a little better had he stood up in the Areopagus and said, well, look, you've got a lot to choose from there. It's really just a matter of picking the flavour that suits you best. But that's not what Paul says. See, in our society today, we'll say many paths but one God. But Jesus says that's not true. Jesus says that he is the way, the truth, not a way, not a truth. He is the way, the truth, the way to God. I suppose that's one of the things that I find quite perplexing about this religious pluralism that we have in our society, is that people are happy with the idea of truth when they go to see their doctor or when they go to see their mechanic. I mean, there's truth in those circumstances and we want to know the truth so that we can apply the truth. I mean, I don't want my mechanic to say, well, look, I feel that. If my water pump is broken, I need to know this information before I drive my car. Because it doesn't matter how he feels, I do want to know the truth. So why is it that when it comes to the most significant issues in our life, issues of meaning and purpose, issues of life after death, why do we want to just say that that's a matter of personal preference, that there is no truth? Well, can I say that brings me to the fourth thing that Paul does. Paul is committed to the truth, but Paul is also respectful of the views that other people have. As he stands up in the Areopagus, he does so respectfully. The Areopagus was the place in Athens where the latest religious ideas and moral ideas, even political ideas and philosophical ideas, would have been debated. This is where the thinkers got together to talk about the big issues of life. So Paul has been invited to speak there because he's saying something that they haven't heard before. And as he stands up in the Areopagus, he doesn't get up there and say, you know all those gods you've got lining your street, you should bulldoze them because they're worth nothing. No, he doesn't say that. He says, I've walked around your city, I understand that you guys are very religious people. And I saw a statue to an unknown God and I want to tell you about that God. See, he speaks respectfully. He's committed to the truth, but he's gentle and respectful. There's a verse in 1 Peter where 1 Peter talks about the fact that Christians ought to be like that. He says, but in your heart set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. Sometimes Christians are accused of being arrogant, and it's mainly because sometimes they are, and they shouldn't be. They ought not to be arrogant. They need to believe what they believe and explain it to others with gentleness and respect. We need to seek to understand what it is that other people believe and think. We need to seek to understand the religion that they are a part of, what it is that they believe, how they think this world holds together, where there is purpose in this life. And when we speak, we need to do so with gentleness and respect. Let me just finish with one more idea about how postmodernism, I think, has impacted the world that we're a part of. Wasn't that long ago that if you went to the New South Wales Art Gallery and you were looking at a painting, you'd be trying to figure out what the artist was wanting to communicate, what the artist had intended in their work of art. But in our postmodern world, we question whether or not we can actually understand what the artist was trying to do. And now it's really just a matter of how it impacts me, how it makes me feel. The question of what the artist wanted to do has become somewhat irrelevant. It's really about how it impacts me, how it makes me feel. Well, that principle was then moved over into literature. So you could no longer really ask intelligently what the author was attempting to do. It was really just a matter of how did this impact me? How do I feel about what is being written here? One of the mantras in postmodernism is that the reader is the author. The reader gets to decide what this means, how we are to understand this. The reader determines the text. Within your reading community, the people that you mix with, you decide what this passage means. The only question that you need to ask is, what does this mean for me? Now, I don't think it's too hard to see where this may actually impact Christianity. When it comes to looking at the Bible, how are we to view what the Bible says? If the author is irrelevant, then it's now just a matter of me determining what this text means for me. Well, God becomes rather irrelevant as the author of what we have as the scriptures. And I think we can see this creeping into Christian circles as well. One place where that you can see it is where people say, oh, that's just your interpretation. Well, I want to say that could be correct, but really there are only two options. If it's my interpretation and your interpretation is different, there are two options open for us here. We are either both wrong or one of us is wrong. They're the only options that are available to us. I mean, again, if I go back to my doctor and my doctor says, well, this is the case, and I say, well, that's just your interpretation. My interpretation is very different to that. Well, one of us will be wrong or both of us will be wrong. We can't both be right if we hold conflicting views. And I'm sure that that's the case when it comes to the scriptures. See, we believe that God has revealed himself unambiguously in the Bible. Look at what Paul wrote to Timothy. It says, from your infancy you have known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make you wise for salvation through faith in Christ Jesus. That way, the truth, the life. The Scriptures reveal the truth about who Jesus is. And they reveal them unambiguously. And we know that they can be relied on and they can be trusted because, as Paul goes on to say, all Scripture is God-breathed and is useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting and training in righteousness so that the man of God may be thoroughly equipped. What we have in the Bible is what God has given to us, what God has revealed of himself. He has done so clearly and unambiguously. And if we want to understand the way, the truth, the life, then we need to hear what it is that God has to say to us in his word. Thank you.
Well, now's your chance. If you would like to respond or have questions for our speaker, please make use of the slips of paper that were given to you when you walked in. And Jamie will come around and pick those up and pass them to the speaker. And Luke will answer them in the to the best of his ability in the time that he has left.
Just reading through the questions even as we speak. The first question says this, what about those who've never come in contact with the Bible? Are there other ways to know Jesus? I think I'm going to fudge my answer in part here because I want to say I'm sure that God understands all of those things. Romans chapter 1 says that God has revealed enough of himself in the created world for people to be able to make an intelligent response to him. So I think that the Bible wants to say that God has actually made himself clearly known. I think the Bible also says that it is through Jesus that people will come to know God and enter into that relationship with him. So I suppose I'm not sure that I can give more of an answer than that, that those two things may seem to be in tension, but I'm not sure that they necessarily are. I think it is possible for God to reveal himself clearly enough for people to be able to make that intelligent response. Second question says this, and I haven't even finished reading the whole question yet. Paul reasons in verse 17, in the synagogue, and then in brackets it says the church, and the marketplace, and in brackets secular areas, what are some effective ways that Christians can share the gospel today, given that if we take Paul's approach to reason in the marketplace, it might be viewed as arrogant? Well, I think that the first and the most simple one is don't be arrogant. That might sound sort of too simple, but I think that Christians are arrogant. They very often are. I won't say always. Very often are arrogant. We need to seek to understand what it is that other people believe. We need to seek to understand what they believe if we want to be able to express what it is that we believe. So I think that that can be a great starting point for discussion. I know of someone who met for quite a number of weeks with a Muslim guy because he really wanted to understand what it was that he believed as a Muslim. I can go to Wikipedia and find out a whole bunch of unreliable information about Islam from there, but wouldn't it be better to sit down with someone who is a Muslim and find out what drives them in their life, what motivates them, what hope they have, how it is that they think through life? And then I'll be better in a position to be able to explain what it is that I believe as a Christian. And hopefully that discussion will involve that conversation taking place. I think the marketplace is anywhere in our society. And I think Paul would have seen the marketplace as being anywhere as well. I mean, he quite literally was in the marketplace in Athens. But anywhere that we come in contact with people who don't have that faith in Jesus, I'm sure that part of Paul's reasoning was to say, what is it that you believe? Let me tell you about the God that I believe in. And I'm sure that he would have done that with gentleness and respect.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.